So I'm a little unwell today, as you can possibly hear. So I'm practicing patience, which is not particularly easy for me. I'm not by nature a patient person. So I get to practice patience a lot. I also try not to saddle myself with the command to be patient, because I can't actually do that. I can't actually be patient, but I can practice patience pretty much whenever it's necessary, which is, as I say, a lot. Practicing patience for me involves, first of all, acknowledging that I'm kind of impatient in some situations, say, waiting in line for something, or in a car, or sewing my holy clothes, which are all basically dissolving, and then I drop the needle and I can't find it. These are all occasions where it'd be very easy for me to get quite impatient. So first of all, I have to notice that I'm kind of tensing up. And the easy way to approach the practice of patience, one of the most wide open doors, is to relax physically and notice that whatever is clenched can basically be unclenched. Impatience comes up quite regularly when I'm ill, because lying in bed actually doesn't appeal to me very much, except like at night, that's all right. But to be confined during the daytime is a bit of a trial. So I get to practice patience then too. Practicing patience is a kind of it shows a willingness to practice renunciation. And I thought of that because I noticed that the graphic that I had put on the announcement for the half-day sit today was Shakyamuni, Siddhartha cutting his hair off. Which of course is one of those iconic moments in Buddhism. The favorite son and the prince of the kingdom decides to cut off all his beautiful long hair and seek, I don't know, the truth, something. So to a degree, what we're doing here today is we're cutting our hair off. Instead of perhaps following along with whatever the predilection of the moment is, we're kind of cutting our hair off. Being still when we'd perhaps rather move. Being quiet when perhaps we'd rather talk. Not eating when perhaps we'd rather be having a red velvet cupcake from Starbucks around the corner. They're actually pretty good. I'm surprised. They look awful, but you eat one, and it's actually, this is actually pretty tasty. So this theme of renunciation, you know, is pretty big in Buddhism. Actually can't really get around it. And as is always the case with human experience, there are all kinds of variations on the theme. But the theme is central and quite crucial to our practice. Fortunately, it's worked into the practice very smoothly, so that coming to sit, for instance, involves a certain degree of renunciation. Placing our body in a particular posture involves some renunciation. Just coming into the Zendo and bowing at the prescribed place and so forth also involves some little, you're snipping off a little bit of your carefully maintained hair. And this is pretty critical for the spirit of this practice, because otherwise, if we're not confronting this theme of renunciation in our lives, then we are just kind of running pell-mell before the wind of karma. And that is beyond any doubt the path of suffering. According to Buddha, the path of renunciation is the path of the end of suffering. So if we are Buddhists or something like that, then there's some obligation to investigate that and see whether he was right. Because after all, maybe he was wrong. Maybe there are so many unalloyed delights in this life that we can just kind of go from one to the next without ever encountering anything, you know, bleak or discouraging or frightening or angry making or anything like that. But I don't know anybody with a life like that personally. The ceremony of renunciation maybe has its most elaborate expression in home leaving, which of course is what Siddhartha did. He left his the life that was carefully prepared for him. And in the context of a society where the clan and so forth, family, the generation of heirs, particularly sons, was critical. Buddha had his wife and child, and he just turned his back on all that. So whether that's quite the way to handle things is, well, open to question. Anyway, that's what he did. And I don't imagine that renunciation was any particularly really easier for him than for any of us. In terms of home leaving, we were reading recently in our study hour that there's two kinds. There's the kind of a home leaving of the body, and there's also the home leaving of the spirit. And this is in Keizan's record of transmitting the light. And ancestor Shanavasa asks, soon to be ancestor Upagupta, did you leave home with your body or with your spirit? And Upagupta, being a good monk, says, well, I left home with my body. Namely, I left the family house and my inheritance, my relatives, my friends, and I entered the homeless life. Whereupon Shanavasa reminds him that because Buddhas and sentient beings aren't two, there's no home to leave. And because there is basically one path and one samadhi, there's nothing to turn your back on. And it is said that upon hearing this, Upagupta woke up. So nowadays, we have kind of solemnized this distinction by having these two kinds of ceremonies, like around Zen Center. People who shave their heads and wear the large robe, who in this context are referred to as priests or clergy. And then there are those who wear the small robe, who are said to leave home while remaining there. So when Kazen talks about this, he says, those who leave home in spirit maybe remain in their house, but he says they regard their wife and children and family members as so much dust and trash. That's not altogether comforting if you are part of that family. Be, you know, there's dad, he thinks we're trash. Personally, I don't think that meant that the renunciate was like mean and spiteful towards his wife and child. He says something, Kazen says, never giving thought to love. The one who leaves home in spirit outwardly appears to be leading a perfectly ordinary household life, but in fact has left all that behind. So in the midst of family life and married life and children and so forth, the one who leaves home in spirit is still practicing renunciation. That is still confronting and studying his or her attachments and determining how to practice with them in that context, which is not so easy, particularly if you're attached to somebody. It's pretty challenging, actually. And then, you know, maybe they're attached to you too. So then now you've got two dynamos of attachment working there. And if you're a practitioner, you have to see what does renunciation or non-attachment or home leaving or even patience mean in this context? Ideally, you'll be able to invite your partner or spouse into the home leaving life with you, such that you're both practicing non-attachment with respect to each other. Which does not mean, of course, that you neglect one another, but rather means that you are committed, and possibly publicly committed, to, in a manner of speaking, each of you is committed not to traveling into the next moment with that person, because you can't. There is no person there to travel with. So the notion that, okay, now you have a person, kind of like you have a, you know, pair of shoes, and you're gonna just kind of walk into the future with this on your arm, is an illusion, actually. And if you're a practitioner, it means you're committed to studying that illusion and bringing it up and inviting your partner to study it too. And it's kind of scary, because what then is the basis of your, say, partnership, if both of you are realizing that, well, I can't even go into the next moment with this person, let alone the next 50 years. How am I going to do this? How are we going to do this? And just asking that question is a kind of cutting off there. Pardon. And, you know, most folks don't do it. And they're not to be blamed. If you ask people generally, you know, hey, how's your life? Well, depending. And then they say, oh, it's okay. I'm doing all right. And it's not up to us. It's not up to practitioners to argue with that. But if instead people say, well, I'm kind of suffering. In fact, I'm suffering a lot. In fact, nobody knows the troubles I've seen. Then it's like, well, what do you think that's about? Then you might have an interesting conversation about how they've been kind of, as they sort of were taught, you know, it's like, well, get some stuff and some people that make you happy, and then go into the next moment with them. Take all that stuff and that person or people and go into the next moment. Just travel with them. And then you can ask, well, did you actually ever look to see if that's possible? Or did you notice that in the next moment there's actually kind of another person there? And the stuff that you brought with you, it's kind of a little different. Because there's no separation between kind of how I think that recorder thing is, how I experience that in my life. There's no, it has no being beyond that. So I can't even take the little Zoom H2 recorder into the next moment with me, let alone another person. And if I do, if I try to, that is, then more suffering. So Buddha cutting his hair off was all about this the fact that this single moment is it. And Buddha was determined that his life should reflect that truth, and that that should be his study as long as he lived. So there's no reason we can't all do that as well. There's no reason at all that that kind of renunciation needs to be regarded as outside of our practice or our grasp. If we don't think that Buddha's insight into reality is valid or useful, then we are under no obligation at all to have anything to do with it. On the other hand, if we suspect that he might be right, then it's maybe worth cutting your hair off for. And you may decide, okay, I'm going to be a real home leaver, and I'll even shave my head and live in poverty and wander the world like a clouds and water monk. Or you may say, I'm going to practice renunciation in the very context of this life that I'm now living, with people and things constantly inviting me to carry them into the next moment. Either way, your practice renunciation will affect the world. And to the degree that the enunciation is not, you know, it's not violent or disrespectful or contemptuous, it has a kind of a gentle, rather sweet feeling, which other people are encouraged by. So none of this is easy. our main attachment, or I don't know, maybe not yours, but my main attachment is to this body, especially when it gets ill. So practicing renunciation and patience in the midst of illness is quite powerful. Eventually, we'd like to be able to, you know, when it seems like the term of a particular life is coming to an end, we'd like just to be able to open our hand and let it go. Like Layman Pong horsing around with his daughter. I forget the exact details, but he's like, he's about to die or something. And so he goes and sits on, he has this wonderful carved seat. So he goes and he takes up his place in this carved seat as he's about to pass away. And his daughter, who's also a practitioner, says, "Hey, Daddy, look at this outside here. Come here a second." He's like, "No, wait, I'm dying." She said, "No, no, come look at this." So he gets up, he goes and looks out the window. Meanwhile, she runs and sits in his chair and she dies first. And he's laughing. I suppose it sounds macabre, but anyway, that was the kind of sense of humor they had back then. I think the wife passed away too, somewhat in a similar mystical way, just sort of like, okay, I'm dying now. Well, this shows, you know, not being fooled by the surface of things. This shows the willingness to leap ahead into the void, since that's all that's ahead is the void. That's all that's present. And when we start to see and experience and understand our lives in that context, there's peace. There is great peace. So thanks for practicing renunciation today and every day. And if you'd like to ask some question or share something about your own practice, that would be great. Yes.
That story, the last story, who is that about?
Layman Pong, Pong Yun.
Pong Yun.
Very, very famous lay practitioner and revered throughout East Asia, because he and his family were people who, in the midst of complex Confucian, you know, familial relationships, fully practiced the way. So he's thought to be pretty cool. Of course, in the Vimalakirti Sutra, he's the one whose understanding surpasses that of everyone except Shakyamuni. As you may know, in that sutra, Vimalakirti is ill. He's another famous lay practitioner. He's the one who bests all of Buddha's finest debaters and shows up their lack of understanding, just as Pong Yun tends to do in his encounters with people. He also meets up with monks and so forth and puts them to shame with his understanding. So as Buddhism developed, the possibility of depth and power of practice that is not constrained by immediate context came to the fore. So how are y'all doing with renunciation? Yes.
How do you renunciate without making it important?
How do you renounce
without making it a big deal?
Well, making it a big deal would be kind of like extra. So you just stop short of that. There's the renunciation, and then if you're going to make it a big deal, that's already okay. That's another step. So it's like, well, don't take that step. Just open the hand, whatever it is. Let it go, relax, let the breath out, and don't try to, you know, make that into anything. Because if there's the persistent picture of renouncer, the thing renounced, and the act of renunciation, that's already a wrong view. So like in the Diamond Sutra, it says, if a bodhisattva gives a gift with no notion of gift, giver, or receiver, that's excellent. So it's the same. As long as one is practicing renunciation without any particular idea, oh, now I'm practicing renunciation, or at least if you have that idea, it's just a thought, then that's a powerful practice.
Just say a little bit more about how one goes about practicing in the midst of some discomfort above and beyond just noticing that that's what's happening.
Well, there's no one prescription that meets all circumstances. Beyond that sort of general stuff, I've had some experience with kidney stones, and believe me, it is really hard to practice renunciation when you're in that much pain, because the more intense the pain, the stronger the self-reflex is, and the stronger the impulse to find a way to protect oneself, get away from whatever that threat is, and so forth. It's very, very strong. So it's pretty hard. And the only way you do it is instant after instant after instant. You can't fix it and then just let it roll. I can't, anyway. Practice is always this moment, this moment, this moment. Renunciation is always like that. So if I'm in a lot of pain or very, very uncomfortable, then the only way I can practice with that is now, now, now. And if one is in fact clearly observing moment by moment, that is a full practice right there. That's also a kind of renunciation, because you're no longer pulling the strings, trying to nail stuff down, get it all set the way you like. You're not doing that. As Merging of Difference and Unity says, reality constantly flows. Oh no, sorry, that's the song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. And since that's the truth, you can't make it stop. You can't make it hold still. So this effort to renew our vow, renew our practice of renunciation, renew our home leaving, moment after moment after moment, is extremely powerful, and I think what Buddha had in mind. Yes?
So you do that because you heard about it?
Well, let's see, I certainly used to do that because I heard about it. Anymore, I kind of wonder, why do I do this? It gets harder to say. After a while, it's just, well, that's what I do. When I started practice, when I was in my teens, I really thought I knew what I was doing. Quickly became obvious that that was not true. And then after as years of practice accumulate, the temptation grows to think, okay, now I didn't know it before, now I know. But actually, it's the opposite. Less and less do I know what I'm doing. And more is that a relief.
Now, I was thinking, as you were talking, I could relate to, at one point you used the term let go.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah, I think that's part of it, because sometimes in my own life, I kind of just let go of things, and I feel that's one way of kind of renouncing it.
Yeah.
But then you brought up those kidney stones.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, you're not going to let go of that because the feelings won't let go of you.
Right. Well, if any of you have had kidney stones, and I think the doctor will back me up on this, one interesting thing about kidney stones is you cannot be still. As distinct from, I believe, doctor, it's gallstones, where you can't move.
On a peritonitis, you can.
Yeah, it's like don't touch me. I am not moving. Kidney stones, you are like writhing all over the place. So, again, there's nothing you can really do about that except allow each moment to arise and notice how desperately you're trying to hang on to something. Like, how can I get from here where I am to some place called no pain, for instance? How can I do that? And to relax is of course the most obvious ceremony of renunciation, is to relax the body. It's really hard when you're in that much pain. So all I can suggest is that let's not let our some idea we may have that we can only practice under ideal circumstances. Let's not fall for that. So what's tempting for me is, if I'm having a kidney stone attack, to think, okay, I can't practice now. Give me some morphine and then I'll practice. It's like, I don't want to fall for that. I want to make the effort over and over again to renounce my attachments, to relax the body, to be open to what's coming up, to acknowledge fear and anger and so forth, moment by moment, as it happens, without trying to make camp anywhere. And it's a slippery slope. On the other hand, even just in doing that a little bit in the midst of difficult circumstances is like an eye-opener. When you see, oh, it is possible. It makes a huge difference. Yes?
So as you're talking about some of the physical distresses of the body and the ways of becoming present in the moment of each moment and what's there, then the people and things that we gather that we've been trying to
yes.
take with us, which sounds like a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
It would be that we would just meet each moment, the people and things.
Right. As they are. Which is, they have no fixed nature. This is Buddha's fundamental insight. So if we're relating to things and people as though they did have fixed nature, that's the path of suffering. And that includes this body. If I'm relating to this thing, this being, this creature, as something with fixed nature, then if it gets a kidney stone attack, it's going to be very unhappy. Because wait, that's not how things are supposed to be. So if instead, you know, to acknowledge over and over again the specificity and also the limitlessness of each moment is a crucial and powerful practice. It's no different from what we call zazen. It's just the same. And when we're know, confined in a little basement room and sitting still for certain periods of time, it's definitely going to come up that, well, this isn't exactly what I had in mind in terms of comfort and, you know, having a nice weekend. It wasn't exactly it. So, okay, great. Now here it is. It's not as intense as a kidney stone, but there's a little edge there, enough that we can actually practice with it. And so, like, well, maybe we don't have to wait till, like, you get hit by a car to do that practice. Maybe you can start when things are less intense and get a feeling for it. Find out for ourselves what that means to practice in this moment with nothing else. As various Chan exemplars have told us, not even the Buddhas will save you. My old friend Da Hui says stuff like that. They will not save you, he says. And of course he's right. Well then, what's all this talk about, like saving beings? Well, that's not something you do to some other being. Beings are saved and awakened together. And that's the work. So I don't plan on doing much else with my remaining days. And, it's nice having some other people to practice with. We're not even giving you lunch today. Sorry, it's kind of mean of us. But we do have tea and cookies, which we will give you in a little while after making you sit some more. Actually, we're not making you do anything. Y'all can leave if you want, but then no cookies. So we'll end with just the brief monthly ceremony for our founder, Isan. And then you can see what the rest of the day has in store for you. So thank you all for coming, and thank you for helping to make this happen. And thanks, of course, to Cheryl, who dots so many I's and crosses so many T's, it's hard to imagine this place without it. But we may have to someday, so. Try to be ready for anything, even another kidney stone.